Hello, everyone, and welcome from here in the capital city of Austin, Texas. This is Capital Geek, a podcast dedicated to the founders and operators that create the products we love and turn them into fabulous companies with meaningful exits. Whether you're raising your first round of capital or racing toward an IPO, this is where we deep dive on the lessons learned from seasoned industry veterans, geeks of all types, the experts leading product and engineering teams, operations and finance, or sales and marketing, and we'll both learn from their mistakes and celebrate their successes while providing a roadmap for you to accelerate your own journey toward success. My name is Josh Stevens, CTO at Elsewhere Partners, and I am the Capital Geek. On this episode of Capital Geek, we geek out with my good friend and network automation geek, Chris Wade. We discuss trends in the network automation industry, best practices, and how to integrate NetOps with your CloudOps and SRE teams. This one's super geeky, so hold on tight and let's get started. Chris Wade, good morning, sir. How the hell are you?
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure to hang out with you and chat. It's a little bit of an interesting time right here, a few days before the inauguration of Biden, huh?
Oh, man, I didn't know you were going to go there to start off.
Well, how can you start anywhere else right now? I mean, the whole world is freaking out about it. How are things down in Atlanta?
Good. I mean, as far as Georgia goes, we were kind of in the middle of this lately. So it's like, you know, my kids on TV can't see anything other than political advertisements. So I think we're going to get back to some regular TV.
So that would be a really nice change for a while. But I'll tell you, it's a beautiful day here in Austin. The sun's shining, the birds are singing. So it's still a great day to be an American in my book.
Absolutely.
Network automation. When did you first realize that that was where you wanted to focus for the next stage of your career?
For sure. So basically how we've been managing networks has been the same for a long time. And that's really been CLI based. So it was a bunch of highly trained individuals on top of complex networking equipment. And we've been doing speeds and feeds. We've been improving networks as far as I can remember. But what really happened about 5 years ago was we started talking about network becoming more like software. And that kind of virtualization and programmability of the networking to the rest of infrastructure is very normal. Like compute and storage has gone through this. And what we saw is basically networking, which has been highly vertically integrated for the past 30 years, is now starting to become more like software and becoming programmable. So the idea is really that we need a new ecosystem to kind of take advantage of this programmability, and how we've been managing networks is not going to transition to how we manage software-based, kind of cloud-based networking infrastructure.
So I think I see your point, with compute, with storage, and really everything we do today in a modern DevOps or a cloud engineering team, it's all done as code. It's all automatable. The culture is so different for teams that are using automation tools that I could see why you would have seen this early and thought, wow, this is, how do we make this same reality true for the network space?
That's right. And if we think about how we manage networks, we're always talking about risk mitigation. We have this, network infrastructure that, we can only change in the middle of the night. We have to have highly trained individuals. We have to go through change management boards. If I go talk to my application team who's building code here and I say, all right, we're only going to change code in the middle of the night, we got to make sure we don't break anything. Like, it's kind of flipped on its head. It's like, how do we make the system redundant? And how do we apply DevOps principles to how we manage network infrastructure? Now, obviously, there's a fiber optic cable coming out of our office here. Like, I can't make that redundant without extreme cost. But, as we start moving networking into software, we start seeing innovation again. So I think that'd be my big point for the day is, networking has been boxes and wires for a long time. But once we start turning it into software, we're kind of creating this whole ecosystem of how do I get network as a service? How does multi-cloud networking work? How does network meshes and Kubernetes pods work? Like, the OSI model still prevails and networking is still networking, but it's taking in new shapes and morphing into how do I solve new problems. And there's this whole ecosystem built around how we've managed networks historically And the question is, how much of that translates and how do we have to have new practices to kind of deal with it?
It definitely seems as if it's due sort of a generational leap forward. And I love what you said about the culture on those teams being all about managing risk. You know, it's sort of like managing, you know, an insurance company or something where you're thinking about loss as opposed to gain. And what we see in modern DevOps teams is that it's all about the gain. It's about how can we push technology forward faster to have a bigger impact on the business. Whereas you're right, in the networking world, for as long as I've been a network engineer, which is a really, really long time, you know, it's all been about just don't cause an outage, you know, don't cause a performance degradation, don't rock the boat. And I love to see things moving forward rapidly. You said about 5 years ago, you had that realization and you set down a path to change it. Tell us about the path that you've taken from that time through today.
So I guess it seems like ancient history at this point, but there was, you know, the idea was there was a lot of Google and Stanford people talking about how we were going to basically turn networking into software. And there was these open source initiatives around controllers and orchestrators. And the early idea was we were going to remove the control plane from the router. So the router's a big vertically integrated, you know, box. And if we can remove the brain from it, then we can just make these cheaper, faster data plane processing boxes. And we can use some of the benefits of software control and centralize that. So, you know, routing protocols can be centrally managed and all that kind of stuff. So the early days, the thought was we were going to have a couple of open source controllers. So like an Open Daylight, which is now under Linux Foundation. The big guys came together and said, hey, we're going to build a new operating system for how we build software control in the networks. What in reality has happened is that the innovation is almost going so fast that nobody could wait on the group think to get that down. So just like in the software-defined WAN space, you have 50 vendors all with their bespoke controllers. So I really think that from a networking standpoint, we've kind of unleashed the beast, which is awesome. But we're going to get innovation cycles so fast now that it's really not normal kind of in the networking space. Like a new line card with new speeds and feeds with maybe a new routing protocol was normal. But the idea that the level of innovation on different types of networking technologies is you know, accelerating faster than I've ever seen it. I mean, I don't know what you think.
I think it reminds me of what we saw in the early to mid 90s. You know, where things were changing so fast that you could not wait upon a standards body or, you know, the IEEE or an RFC committee to come up with some sort of a standard. You just ran as fast as you could. And whoever grabbed the most market share, the way they did it became the standard. I can remember when NetFlow first came out, it was a game changer. And there were multiple specifications, but there was an RFC spec, there was Cisco's version, and you know, there was also SFlow and IPFix. Yep. And eventually, the majority of the market just said, oh, we'll just use Cisco's model and just kind of go from there. I can remember at SolarWinds, when I was building the NetFlow product, we wanted to go support Juniper. And they used something called JFlow. And so we started researching it. And finally, as a test, we just turned it on to see what would happen. And it worked flawlessly, because it was the same exact thing as Cisco's NetFlow, same structure in the packets. And so it was easy to add support for that. It feels sort of like that, but on steroids. It feels like that, but much, much faster. And what I love about it is that we've sort of unsiloed the network team. You know, for years, the network team had this elite status among the rest of the infrastructure team because, again, it was about managing risk. If you took the network down, you're just out of luck. A good buddy of mine, Dan Schoenbaum, was just sending me a Slack message. And out where they live in Portland, they're having a horrific windstorm today. And internet service is down and phone service is spotty. And, you know, his wife's a general counsel for a tech firm. Dan works with me on several different projects we're working on together now with companies we've invested in. And they're, you know, they're dead. There's nothing they can do. They can't get out to the internet. They can't use Zoom. They can't make a phone call. They can't use Slack because the network's down. And the network's down, everything's down.
I mean, my kids, we had the power go out and they said, that's all right, I'll just get on my iPad. I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, has a battery in it. I'm like, well, like, is going through that router that's plugged into the wall, which has no blinky lights on it. So therefore,
yeah, it's really interesting.
Let me ask you about the silo conversation, because the other part of this is that as we start to adopt like cloud-based networking with a VPC and AWS, which is basically just Amazon's router that you're consuming, you know, a lot of CIOs are splitting the NetOps team from that cloud, you know, SRE DevOps team. And even though we might not be siloing with an infrastructure, a big question we have that we talk about is how do CIOs view their networking NetOps team and their SRE cloud-based team? Because I think a lot of CIOs have been very comfortable splitting those teams and saying, we lift and shift an application from the data center into the cloud. And it goes from, you know, my networking team to my cloud team. And I think with AWS, sometimes they call it the AWS effect. When people went into the cloud, networking was maybe viewed as less important.
Yes.
Because configuring my Claus Fabric in my data center might be viewed as complicated, and doing a transit gateway in a VPC might be thought of as simpler. So, you know, people thought, I'm just going to keep moving things to the cloud, and networking maybe, you know, from an enterprise CIO perspective might be less important. But now what we talk about is, as we've started to get outside of just AWS and you start, you know, I have stuff going through Equinix, or I'm connecting to SaaS platforms like Salesforce or ServiceNow, I have a hybrid multi-cloud story. The way we talk about it is your network exploded on the internet. So it went from like inside the four walls of my data center to people swipe credit cards to now I'm in AWS to now, like, what is your network? Like, where's it at?
It's a great question. And I think for very large companies that have a lot of owned infrastructure, it probably makes sense to have a NetOps team that may be separate. But, you know, I meet more and more companies today that don't really even have an IT team separate from their SRE team, because all of their infrastructure is in the cloud. And I think that one of the problems we're facing right now is we haven't done a good job of teaching our cloud engineers, our SRE teams, about networking. And if they really understand networking at an advanced level, you know, that improves security of your cloud operations. It includes performance of your cloud operations. But it's dangerous, I think, to consider networking as, oh, I only need to know the fundamentals. I only need to know enough to get by. Because if you're not good at segmenting those networks and providing the right safeguards in between them, you're leaving an opening for a hacker to get in and make hay.
Yeah, I mean, the OSI model still prevails. I mean, just because it's a VPC or a transit gateway or, you know, an Equinix cross-connect ECX service, like, it's still, networking principles still apply. And to your point, you know, it's when it's just a couple VPCs and a couple AWS regions, you kind of have that simplification.
Yes.
I would argue once you explode your network on the internet and you're using SaaS platforms and people are sending their firewall stuff to Zscaler, I'm using NS1 for DNS, you know, it's not just going to a website. Like, you're routing traffic through critical network application infrastructure across WAN links, potentially encapsulated over your internet connection. You know, what used to be simple, now you see those SRE teams in the enterprises you're talking about saying, let's invite the networking guys in, help them explain something to us, and then send them back because I'm going to code it in a Terraform plan or some other thing. And ultimately, I think that, you know, successful organizations are going to, you know, that wall will begin to erode as those teams kind of work together. Now, how they facilitate that, how much of your infrastructure is on the cloud versus on-prem, all that stuff is going to, I think, drive individual decisions. But ultimately, you know, these two worlds are important to work together.
I completely agree. You know, I've been involved recently with some nonprofits doing mentoring and resume reviews and mock interviews for some students that are learning to code. And what I've noticed, even with students that are juniors and seniors in high school, is in many cases, they're very proficient software developers by that age. I'm working with a kid right now. I'm mentoring him. He's a first generation American of Russian descent, brilliant software developer. He codes in 7 or 8 languages. He's already been teaching coding to younger kids. But now that we're having this conversation, I'm realizing that, you know, I don't think these kids are learning very much about network engineering early on. And I think we're moving to a world where, just as I think software development or at least basic coding skills should probably be a prerequisite for 80% of the knowledge workers out there, regardless of your field. I think network engineering skills, at least the basic understanding of when you're over your head so you can bring in some help, is also something we need to, you know, spread around the team. I've just seen that it's really hard to find SRE teams that are really well-rounded. And so I think we have to do something to change that.
Yeah. And, you know, back to your coding example, for proficient software developers, a question I ask, and you know, we run the danger of sounding like angry old networking guys here pretty soon. you know, the system administration skills just of infrastructure, if you're used to just consuming containers, like environments, like in, you have an environment as a service almost in this cloud environment. You know, the idea that there's, you know, hard disks attached and you have to concern yourself with different pieces of infrastructure is almost kind of the first wave before people are really concerned with networking. The flip side is if you believe in the mech and edge world, if you believe in the super macro effect that, you know, we centralized for the last 15 years and it might swing back the other way where a lot of your workloads and a lot of your applications are going to take advantage of some sort of edge infrastructure, you would start to think that the networking component of that continues to kind of increase in importance of how you think of actually building things. Because right now it's, you know, there's some edge applications. You go talk to a manufacturer, they might have, you know, Ford Motor Company, I'm assuming, has some stuff in the manufacturing plant because they don't want to lose connection to a cloud far away. But there's going to be all sorts of edge opportunities between the public clouds pushing out, service providers providing mech edges. And I think as you build applications that take advantage of edge, you know, networking considerations are going to become more and more important. I just see lots of tailwinds towards, you know, networking, whether it's the innovation on networking products or taking advantage of highly distributed workloads to invent new ways of achieving things.
Chris, if I would imagine some of our listeners out there aren't old angry network guys like you and I, and might be wondering what you know, edge services are. Maybe you could spend just a moment and describe that for people.
Sure. So, you know, if we kind of go back to, you know, thin clients, back with the Sun Microsystems used to have thin clients where most of the compute processing was off. And then we went to a lot of just, you know, PCs. I'm on a Mac Pro today and the processing in this thing's crazy. And then obviously with public cloud, that was an extension of centralized workflows, whether it's, you know, mainframes and other things. So we put all the compute, the big building, and we all connect to it. And, you know, the most common nomenclature is, you know, you use your cell phone, it doesn't use as much battery, but there's a refrigerator on the other end and some public cloud producing those maps and emails for you. So we've really pushed a lot of the compute into that public cloud infrastructure, which has unleashed all sorts of innovation. But there's a thought that as wireless networks become faster, as the fiber optic cables we're connected to become faster, that we can start to do some low latency applications. So whereas 4G, a lot of people would credit that kind of innovation allowing something like the iPhone to exist. You know, there's a thought that, you know, whether it's, you know, you hear crazy things like, you know, autonomous vehicles using the mech sites, but how do I push the compute closer to the edge, closer to the end user, so that we can innovate on some new things? You know, there's a lot of discussion. I think CES was this week.
Yeah, it was.
I think they were talking about a lot of the stadiums producing, you know, local high-res feedback from replays on the field to your phone. So they need to move that compute. We don't want a round trip time, you know, to Virginia every time we're going to do something. So, you know, there's a big debate. I was at a trade show where somebody said, you know, one of the use cases is remote surgery. And then they asked the room who wants to raise their hand to be the first, you know, cadre of people going to enter the remote surgery game. But, you know, I think there's a lot of thoughts around this unleashing kind of a set of applications that weren't possible before. So it's hard for us to almost think about what these can be, but there's a tremendous amount of innovation being thought of on the edge. I mean, think about with coronavirus, we've been on Zoom calls. People are having a little bit of, you know, Zoom overload. Fatigue.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I could put all the codecs closer to the edge, if I could integrate it with my unified communications, if I can push some of that real-time stuff to the edge, then maybe we get more of a real-time experience. Maybe it becomes more normalized. Maybe my kid's Oculus starts to play some new games that weren't possible before. I don't know.
That's really fascinating. Edge computing and SD-WAN are all over the news right now. And it's gratifying for me because, these technologies have been around for a really long time, but it's taken a while for us to innovate business use cases that made sense to people, where they could really sort of take advantage of them in a way where they saw ROI and it was measurable. And so for me, at least, it feels like for the last 6 to 12 months, the market has just dramatically accelerated. It seems like we waited longer than we should have, and now everyone's trying to run fast to keep up and catch up to where they should have been.
Yeah, and the byproduct of this is at some point we have to figure out how to take advantage of it. There's a chicken and egg, discussion around does this explosion of bandwidth that might come with 5G and this ubiquity of compute, does that facilitate application developers to innovate something new, or do we need to invent something new that drives the demand for increased bandwidth? And I think it's a great debate. I think time will tell, but at the end of the day, how much bandwidth do you need? How much compute do you need? We seem to figure out pretty good ways to keep the consumption model going.
Oh yeah, for sure. It's really fascinating to me to think about, for you as well, how our entire world has evolved around the evolution of the network and bandwidth availability. When I started my professional career in the military, I think I built the very first website for the Air Force, including the one for my base, because it was brand new. I mean, hardly anyone used the internet back in the early 90s. And I can remember when a 14.4 modem was just screaming. And if the whole office, the whole building shared a T1 at 1.54 megabits per second, like, you were just fat and happy. We would go to the office at night to download big files because it was so much faster. And now we have gigabit to our homes and 200 megabit to our mobile phones in our pockets. I mean, it's really fascinating. And the amount of innovation that it's allowed, and quite frankly, for the last year, I think it's allowed many of us to continue to work and stay in business, because without viable bandwidth, we wouldn't be working from home via Zoom.
Yeah, I mean, as terrible as this has all been, it's hard to imagine what would have happened maybe 15 years ago as far as economically or to our personal lives without some of this technology.
Can you imagine what the lines would have been like at Blockbuster if we were all locked in our homes, back in the mid 90s? And we're waiting for the newest release to come out on DVD or VHS, and we're all in line standing 6 feet apart. It would look like a bread line from World War II or something, or the Depression. And we're all waiting to exchange that DVD.
Well, I always remember the Blockbuster. You would go up and there would be a picture of it, and you'd have to pick it up and see if there was a movie behind it,
Yeah.
So it's like, is there one back there? And then you'd go to the return bucket and say, like, can I peruse what just got returned to see if I can steal it before it gets back?
Oh, I've done that so many times. I'd ask the person behind the counter, hey, could you look and see if this movie might have just come in? Yeah, it's an amazing opportunity for us here. And what I hope happens next, and what I've seen already begin to happen, is that while the last year has been horrible, there's no doubt about it, we have made a lot of progress as a country in terms of leaping forward, I would say, a generation in terms of how we use technology and how we think about work. And now we have the opportunity to do things like maybe ask your city to work from home as much as they can certain days and accelerate road construction. That's always been a huge problem for us in these cities like Austin and Atlanta. Anywhere that's growing fast is, how do you upgrade your infrastructure without having such a negative impact on local business? But we've proven now that most of us can work from home in a lot of these jobs if we need to or want to. And You know, for me, it's it as I walk around downtown Austin now, and I think about my friends and the way they're working, it feels sort of European to me. There are more bicycles out than ever before. People are taking walks. They're working a little less. They're spending more time with their families. It feels like from a culture perspective, we might end up in a really good place when this settles down and vaccine has been distributed and the crisis is over. And now we're trying to leave that section of our history.
I mean, we've made a lot of big promises around digital transformation, you know, and that's been an umbrella term that I think's probably been used quite a bit. And I think it's been, you know, one of those things spoken about and not lived for a lot of organizations and cities, to your point. In the last 12 months, I think people would agree we've got 5 or 7 years worth of digital transformation out of necessity. And the question is whether the benefit of that has been, you know, identified and understood enough so that we continue at a similar pace, on the digital. Because ultimately, if I can get my decal on my car without going to the DMV, and if I can do all those things, then that's more time to ride bicycles in Austin and the street, like you said.
I mean, I had a doctor's appointment this morning from this very room, you know, over Zoom with my physician. And if you rewind a year, mostly what you saw were offshore telemedicine companies, which offered an alternative to going into the office, or you could go see your local physician. But there weren't a lot of local physicians who were also doing telemedicine. And that's all changed now, I think, for the better. And I think we're going to invent lots of new ways to be more productive and happier. One of the companies that I worked with, they're called LitLingo. I'll give them a shout out now. And they make an AI-based application that provides analytics and also real-time correction when you're saying something you shouldn't say over Slack, email, Teams, Zendesk, or ServiceNow. Whether it's employee contractor type data or DEI type data or anything that you would say that would cause corporate risk. And it's going just really, really well. And so long story short, we had a holiday party for the company, and it was done over Zoom, and it was a small company, you know. So I put a big monitor in the kitchen. And they used a company called Truffle Shuffle, and they sent everybody a box of ingredients for a couple of cocktails and a dinner. And a French chef came on the Zoom and taught everyone how to make the dish. So as a group, we all cooked in our own kitchens at home, made the cocktails, enjoyed them, cooked and ate dinner together, but all done from the safety of our homes, all via this remote chef experience. And it was fantastic. It was one of the best Christmas parties I've ever been to, or holiday parties.
Very interesting. As much as a lot of these things have been good, the flip side, obviously, to talk about the other side, is the level of collaboration. I still think we have a long way to go before some of the Zoom calls could be as collaborative as we are, you know, in a software development shop. You know, nothing replaces the whiteboard and the marker and big brains in the room. I don't know how we overcome that, but there's It's really about the balance between all of these things. I know I like to get out more. I'm actually in our office. We have a lot of space here, so we get to spread out. I get to escape too many kids being loud at home. But the somehow we have to bring that balance of collaboration in the workspace and augmented by the benefits we've talked about.
I agree. I mean, so many times for the last year, I've said, you know, I've been chasing this problem for weeks, but it feels like if I could get into a room with a whiteboard for a couple of hours with the two or three people I need to collaborate with, we could solve the problem. And, you know, Lucid Spark recent release, it's pretty cool for a whiteboarding tool to use from home, but you're right. It doesn't replace the in-person whiteboard experience. It's at least for me, it's the hardest thing that I do to try to do remote. And I don't think anyone's found the right solution. Although my brother, Zach, who works at SolarWinds, shout out to you, Zach. When he moved recently and he didn't have room in the rental house that he's staying in till his house that he's building is finished for his like 80-inch 4K TV.
Sure.
So he hung it in his office and they set up like a telepresence. And for him, it is very much like a life-size meeting. And maybe there's a solution there somewhere in there around how we do whiteboarding if it was big enough. But that's an example, I think, of an area that we really haven't advanced. I mean, I don't think I've bought anything new for my home office since the pandemic started. So I like haven't gone out and bought a giant screen or a telepresence unit or something to make, you know, doing Zoom calls all day long easier. And we could extend the experience at home to make it more productive. Yet so far, what most of us have done is try to get by with whatever we were using before for the, you know, the odd late night meeting or sometime maybe when you were sick. But I think there's a lot of innovation to be done for how we equip home offices now that we're working there, maybe half the time forever, or maybe more than that.
Yeah. And if you think about the networking side of this, you know, we had WANs and we had office buildings. And if you wanted to gain access to your email, you had to VPN to,
yeah,
basically you VPN'd into the WAN so that it looked like you were sitting in your office. And you know, I'm sure you've had a guest on for Zero Trust. I'm sure you've talked about, you know, quite a bit. You know, people are everywhere. You know, how do I securely perform whatever I'm doing from anywhere I want to, with the expectation of quality and security and everything else that goes into it.
So what we've really talked about is over the last year, there's been a gigantic amount of change for the attack surface for any company in the world, really. You've got people working from home, maybe shared offices on a continuous basis. What is the role of network automation with all of this change and how it's evolving?
So if we go back to something we said earlier, there's, you know, the network device, the traditional network device is a vertically integrated box, control plane, data plane. It routes packets. It does what it does. As we start to turn that into software, we have new ways to operate that. And we start to have these software controllers on top. So instead of configuring networks box by box, so if I have 10 boxes in a data center and I want to change a path, I might need to do some configuration on different devices. Now we have like this intelligence being built into each of these domains. And instead of an application being in a single data center, you know, the Zoom call that we're on is traversing lots of services, some of them cloud services, some installed software, some routing things. So the question is, how do I make changes to applications that, you know, back to have exploded on the internet? It's not just installing software on my laptop, but I have to coordinate control across a variety of technologies that are all, you know, interlocked in some way. So from a network automation standpoint, we think it's very important that people think about kind of the end-to-end service. We think that they need to continue to increase kind of the modern networking concepts. So you can take advantage of all these things. And then the question is, how do you operationalize it? So network automation starts to look a lot more like programming infrastructure than traditional network CLI. So how do we achieve that end to end? And how do you interact with a lot of IT systems? Because if we look at changes to the network, when we look at it, usually like 8 to 12% of somebody's time is spent actually changing the network device. Back to the risk mitigation in the middle of the night, we know it's like a bunch of pre-checks and post-checks and copy-paste into tickets and change. There's all these kind of IT integrations. So it's not just automating, quote unquote, the network. It's also kind of the entire end-to-end process. I mean, I don't know. I mean, what's the average number of SaaS applications that the companies you work with use?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. Well, I will tell you this. We invested in a company about almost 2 years ago that had about 30 employees, 25, 30 employees. And when we inventoried the SaaS apps that they use as part of the business, you know, not things that people use personally, there were 84 of them.
There you go.
So, you know, 2.5 times the number of employees. And I don't know if that ratio scales, but what I do know is that we no longer look to our company to provide us with technology. We're, you know, in the old days, the IT team were the only technologists in the company, and you kind of looked at them to provide solutions. But now, you know, if you're working in a tech company, especially, but really in many different specialty fields, everyone in the company is some sort of technologist, and we're all proficient with deploying cloud apps and using SaaS apps and things like that. So, you know, we've democratized the use and acquisition of technology to such an extent that it's hard to put your arms around, you know, and I think people struggle with it.
The other way I would describe it also is that, you know, when the CIO looks at a challenge, they're looking at how to optimize the entire company, right? That's the goal. But we've allowed business units to optimize themselves, which I think, like, to democratizing at the business unit level. So if you think of, like, I'm responsible for, like, authentication. I might optimize myself and say, I'm going to use AD as a service from Microsoft Azure. Like, I'm going to no longer have my server. And then the unified communication person says, I'm no longer going to host an Exchange server. I'm going to use Office 365. The firewall team says, we're going to do Zero Trust. I'm going to use Zscaler. The DNS team says, I'm going to use NS1. And that's those teams trying to use the most modern techniques and technologies to achieve the best outcome for that business unit. But when you step back and you look at the total, now I need to route the traffic from the WAN securely to the Zscaler POP to route back to the data center with low latency to my AWS application. And all of a sudden, networking goes from, you know, this ubiquitous bandwidth that is just always there to now being a critical, or maybe the most critical component of networking my company, which is now expanded across, you know, the internet. And it shows no sign of slowing, you know, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I invested in a company and now work with them called WT Fast, or What the Fast. And it's a network acceleration software for gaming networks. And I'd never given much thought to the challenges of gaming networks, but in many ways, it is a great example of sort of edge computing and how to build very low latency optimized network routes for those users. Because if you're a competitive gamer, you know, half a second, or, you know, 200 or 300 milliseconds of delay from the time you hit the button to kill your enemy to when that packet gets there, it can change your career. It's a really big deal. And, you know, I hadn't really worked with applications in a while that were that latency sensitive at that scale. And so it really is for them about, you know, some sort of a way to optimize and tunnel that traffic to a gaming server on the edge of someone's network and back and forth. So it's been fun working with the team there at What the Fast. And Rob, if you listen to the podcast, hey. But I think you're right. I think it's really, really challenging for these organizations. And by the time, if you're the CIO, by the time you survey what everyone's using and try to put together a cohesive strategy for the organization, it's probably changed. You know, it's changing so rapidly. I don't know how you get in front of it.
And, you know, some people listening might say, well, you know, we've read the stories of people, high frequency trading desks building their own optical network to shave, you know, latency out of trading applications and using the high speed gaming. And these sound very edge, right? These sound very not normal for the greater population. But the question is, what sort of innovation will we imagine a couple years from now as being just part of our life, right? Like what are those applications that are going to improve, you know, our ability to continue to digitally transform and use technology kind of ubiquitously?
It's really amazing. You know, I don't know where we're going from here, but I'm very excited about the level of innovation and the level of change. And for any senior technologist or anyone who's geeky like you and I, this amount of change tends to lead to lots of innovations that are hard to predict. And to me, that makes it a very exciting time to be alive. Maybe we could talk just for a few minutes about Itential. You and Ian started the company. Tell us a little bit about the history and what you guys are doing in 2021.
Sure. So we really looked at where we believe networking was going, and we really felt like this is one of the biggest transformations in networking. You know, we talk about speeds and feeds, but this is really kind of how we consume networking and how we're going to use this technology to really, you know, enable enterprises and service providers. So, you know, we made the, you know, the bet to kind of move out towards where networks were going to be more kind of API centric and be more modern. And we've seen how it's evolved with, you know, different things like SD-WAN, multi-cloud, those types of things. And we're really focused on providing kind of that end-to-end automation concept to your networking and cloud teams. And what that means is that, and we've kind of alluded to this a few times in the podcast, is that we have strong networking talent within the industry. We have growing software development talent in the industry. And the question is, how do we facilitate people participating in automation? Kind of where automations come from is that somebody who understands infrastructure or the network might describe what they want, you know, and if somebody's being fancy and talking agile, then that would be a user story. And it goes over to a developer to instrument. And it kind of, we call it DevOps a lot of times, but really we need SREs that are really thinking about, you know, reducing the toil, doing it themselves. Everybody's participating in automation. And the question is, how do you facilitate that? So we've been working on this low code approach to get the most people to participate in automation, because we think what is thought of as automation today would just be networking tomorrow. Like this concept that you do networking and then you might want to automate it. You know, networking will be automation.
I agree completely.
We will all be working on the machine that automates the network. All of the complexity we just talked about today, you can't linearly grow your team with the complexity of these modern networking infrastructure. So, you know, I like to talk about all the stuff under the hood, but at the end of the day, we're trying to facilitate these teams so that we can have the most people participate in automation with diverse sets of skills to achieve, you know, the outcome, which is ultimately supporting application owners and moving at the speed of the enterprise.
You know, iTangel's offerings have evolved a lot the last few years from, you know, a very robust on-prem product that some of the largest companies and service providers in the world use with your complementary services, obviously. Now with a SaaS version out there for anyone to use, what are some of the, you know, pushbacks that you hear from people in terms of why they might avoid investing in a network automation strategy? And what would you tell those people in terms of why they should think about this for 2021?
Sure. So when we're talking to folks, like this is the concept of automating is not foreign to most people. I would say 4 or 5 years ago when we first started to be talking to people, we had to start with the value of automation. Most people are using Ansible playbooks, they're writing Python scripts. If they're a cloud SRE, they're using Terraform. And if you think about the maturity of automation, it starts off by, I'm trying to make myself more efficient at my job. So I might write a script, I might write a playbook so that I can do my job, you know, more efficiently. The question is, how do we start sharing that intellectual property across the team? How do I share it with the person next to me? Ultimately, how do I make that self-serve for the application owner? So it's really about, it's not about, you know, don't use the technologies you like, you know, from an iTangel standpoint. We're talking about like, we want to do all of the above strategy. You know, all automation is good in some capacity. And a lot of our discussions are really around bring your own automation. Whatever you have, let's bring it. Let's put an API on top of it and let's start instrumenting it together. Because ultimately, we say we're in the trust and confidence business. And that means, you know, back to the risk adverse network engineer, you know, we have to build trust that we can have enough operational control around these things that if you're making changes to critical infrastructure, you're authenticated, we know who you are, we're auditing it, and we're making sure you're not breaking stuff. So it's really about how do we bring kind of individual automation to the larger organization, and how do we facilitate that in such a way that we can use the tools and a lot of the processes that you already have today.
I love iTangel's story because to me, the way you guys built the product and have evolved is like incredibly difficult. You know, we built SolarWinds, and when I built Orion, I can remember, you know, selling the first, you know, few hundred copies, and we were really constrained to, you know, about 1,000 network elements total. And it only takes about 3 big Cisco switches to have 1,000 elements. And I can remember, you know, over time, we improved the product and made it more scalable and more reliable. And eventually we were able to sell to larger environments. With automation, it has to be so reliable and bulletproof compared to a monitoring tool like a SolarWinds that you've got to make sure that it works 100% of the time. And you guys started with the largest networks in the world, bulletproof the solution, and now you're coming down market to other, you know, enterprises and even middle market companies, which to me is really interesting. I think with automation, with infrastructure, especially like the network, and with security, you kind of have to do it that way because you want to be able to be sure that you can satisfy the hardest use cases so that you can make sure that it'll handle what's needed down below. It's not okay to fail. Whereas with a, you know, if you're collecting monitoring data and you miss a polling cycle, it averages out in the end and who really cares? It's very different. So I've been really, really impressed with the way that you guys have built the product and matured it over time.
I appreciate that. I mean, at the end of the day, when you think about automation, there's the thought of, you know, the complexity of your network is somehow correlated to your desire to automate. That's how people traditionally, if you think of RPA, if you think about other parallel automation domains, it's really about like it takes X amount of time and then we're going to do this. The reality is we're moving into a self-serve model for everything. Like there's an expectation, you talked about the democratization earlier. Like I have an expectation that I can turn on Netflix and the show will show up. Our application teams, I mean, we like to think about them as the user of this stuff. They've come to be, their expectations have been changed through SaaS and cloud to the extent that they expect to be able to do it themselves. So it goes from one where, you know, put a ticket in and wait 5 days and then it will be turned up to one of like, how do I enable those teams? How do I provide governance around it to provide self-serve? And that's ultimately kind of where, you know, it's easy to say, harder to implement. But the idea is how do we make it simple enough so that our developer friends, our application owners, which are driving, you know, a lot of the digital transformation, like how do we enable them to consume IT infrastructure in a self-serve kind of cloud governance model, independent of your technology choices and independent of your networking vendors? And that's what really resonates kind of with that handshake between the business units within enterprises being enabled, working with their CIO partners.
That's fascinating. And I think it's so important because what you're doing is you're building in a system of trust so people can validate, you know, the changes that are supposed to be made. And I think in order to do that, you have to first have a brand around your product that people really trust and rely upon. And you guys have built that, which is really just outstanding. One of the other things I love about iTential, and I don't even know if you guys are still doing it, but you had a really fantastic intern program. Are you guys still doing that? Is it something you're still doing? And if so, how's it going?
Yeah, so the handful of us that were here at the beginning, a lot of us were in Atlanta, in Midtown, so we're across the street from Georgia Tech. So we started, I was a co-op from Georgia Tech when I was there. So were a couple of the early developers here. So for one of the first things we did was reach out to start the co-op program. It's really amazing how much smarter the kids are coming out now than when we were coming out. But we always have kind of a whole cohort of co-ops on rotation. Obviously we'd like them to stay as full-time developers, but it's interesting. It's really unbelievable what they can achieve within the time period they're here, how much they become part of the peer group. But also from a culture perspective, it's been really fascinating. It's really enjoyable because you really create that whole environment where people are, you're allowed to not understand something. You're allowed to ask questions. When you have kind of that co-op rotation, it's a little bit different than interns because they do come 3 or 4 times. So by the mm-hmm. time, by the time they leave, they have, you know, 1.5, 2 years worth of full-time experience, which I think is invaluable while you're going through school. You have a different appreciation of what you're learning sometimes, you know, academically, if you have spent more time understanding how it relates solving real world challenges.
I spend a lot of time thinking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and how to integrate some of those concepts into a startup or a scale-up company. Because, you know, you start out with two buddies, you want to start a company. And so you start building something and you add three or four more people. And before you know it, you've got 50 people around, and maybe you all look alike and think alike, who knows? But one thing I love about your co-op program is, you know, I can guarantee you that two old angry guys like you and I have very diverse thought patterns from, you know, kids in college still. And so to me, one of the things that this program does is it adds a great amount of diversity to what you're doing there in the company. If you were going to advise other companies in my portfolio or out in the world who are of similar size as to some advice as they're thinking about starting their own co-op program or college internship program, can you share two or three tips on things they should maybe think keep it about and keep in mind?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, even before I answer that, one of my favorite things when I drive in, dropping kids off at school is coming over the bridge and somebody will be skateboarding from the school over to it keeps me young. So, I think, you know, obviously being physically near makes it easy. You know, if people have to relocate every 3 months, that makes it difficult. So that, I don't know if everybody necessarily has the option of where they're located. I think the most important thing is to partner with the school and really invest time and energy. It's not just, hey, you know, we're looking for some co-ops to help us test stuff. You know, we're looking for giving real world experience to, computer science graduates. And we're gonna offer them every opportunity that everybody, you know, there's nothing that you can ask a co-op to do that you can't ask anybody around here to do. So it's really important that they're treated, the same as they get tickets just like everybody else. They have the opportunity to make the same impact as everybody else. And, I think by the second rotation or third rotation, we might hire a new person and they might not even know that person's a co-op. They might, where are they going? Oh, they're going back to school. Some people would be like, I didn't even realize. I mean, I've been working with that person for 2 months. I didn't realize, you know, that was the.
Yeah. So. I mean, I've been blown away by the skill level of some of these kids I've been talking to. Again, juniors in high school through seniors in college. And several of them very young, you know, junior, senior in high school, junior in college, would be very qualified to work part-time today as a developer.
All day.
And I've challenged several of those kids. I'm like, why are so many students working as bartenders and waiters and waitresses, especially now with COVID? Like, maybe you should be writing code 4 hours a day, you know, throughout your college career. That may be a way we avoid debt in the future, is some sort of work program over the local, you know, companies and startups, especially now that we've learned to work remotely. You know, the first hackathon I was ever a part of was with your company, Chris.
Oh, wow.
And I had, I don't even know that I ever heard the concept before. This was, you know, 3 years ago or something. And since then, I've just become enamored, you know, by the whole concept. Maybe to tell the listeners a little bit about your hackathons and what you've learned from those.
Sure. I think traditionally, you know, when people think about hackathons, it's kind of over the weekend, you know, pizza on the floor, you know, build whatever you want. The coolest thing wins. I think what we found is most useful is having some sort of guidance on what we're trying to achieve. And obviously you want to leave it as loose as possible. But generally speaking, we force is a strong word. We request that you join with people that you don't work with every day, right? So it's a great opportunity for collaboration. We do think it's a mixture of normal work day, and you can work at night, but the thought of, like, you know, Friday at 6 p.m. till Sunday at 8 p.m. is probably not the best idea. So and people are so excited to participate if they know the outcome of the hackathon could influence the product roadmap, could be rolled out on the website, could do something beneficial. So I think, you know, in the traditional sense, like in a university setting, you know, a hackathon might be just the coolest thing wins. But if you talk to folks, they always have the, I've been asking that we do this, or I think this is a good idea. This is the opportunity to, I don't want to say prove that the idea, it should have gone to the top of the list, but this is the opportunity for you to do what you think's best you know, with some guidance. And it's been, you'll see very small stuff like an improvement to the usability of the product that everybody was like, wow, you know, we're gonna merge that in next release, to entire concepts. There was a gentleman who in two different hackathons built the same thing, two variants of it. It was an app store for our automation platform. And now it's core to what we do. We call them pre-builts. And it's the idea is that after I build an automation, I want to be able to share it with everybody else. So now we have this entire developer site. We have all of our pre-builts out on GitLab. And not only can you go download them, but now there's this app store concept in the platform that connects to that GitLab. So if something's promoted tomorrow night, all of our users can have access to that, to download and use that automation. So it's a way to facilitate sharing of different concepts. And you know, that goes back to, maybe we would have thought that was a good idea, but having three people super passionately build that, present it to the team, and then everybody say what a good idea is. I mean, really, really, you know, it's not just a, you know, a thing to mess around. It's really it really facilitates a lot of culture and facilitates a lot of good ideas, frankly.
You know, I love what iTential does. And I think that when anyone works in a field for a decade or something, and it goes out and builds a product or a company that's built specifically to help people who were doing the job they just left do it more efficiently and better. There's something very special and authentic about that process. And that's what I love about what you guys have done, because you took your time in as a network engineer and working at other companies, you saw a way to help, you know, people who were like you, you know, and you built this product to do that. It's really fantastic. For people who don't know the company, we're talking about iTential, iTential.com. And that's Chris Wade's company. Chris, we're kind of running out of time here. Are there any other things you'd like to mention or things you want to talk about before we wrap up?
No, I appreciate the time. And obviously, you know, reach out for any sort of discussion on the topic, whether it's market related or iTential related. We have our commercial website at iTential.com, but we also have our developer site, which this audience maybe would find more fascinating, with all sorts of, you know, different tooling and documentation and other things. That's developer.itential.io. I'm assuming my contact information will be attached to the podcast if anybody wants to reach out.
Yeah, we'll put all that stuff on there, social links and whatnot. Well, Chris, this has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. It's always great to see you. And, you know, for anyone out there who's on a NetOps team or who's thinking about ways to make changes faster in your network, iTential is a great solution. You should check it out. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thanks, Jeff.
That's it, everyone. And thank you for joining Capital Geek. Subscribe via Apple, Stitcher, or any platform where you usually find fantastic podcasts. Tune in again soon for another great episode of Capital Geek.